fingers. He opened his eyes and caught her looking. She blushed.
"Don't get too comfortable," she said, discomposed.
He struggled upright.
"I'm sorry. It's like this after battle."
"Battle?"
He watched guardedly as she processed the idea. She said,
"Battle.
With Chimera.
Because you're enemies."
He nodded.
"Why?
Why?"
he repeated, as if the notion of enemies needed no justification.
"Yes. Why are you enemies?"
"We have always been. The war had been going on for 1,000 years.
"That's weak. Two races can't have been born enemies, can they? It had to start somewhere."
A slow nod.
"Yes. It started somewhere." He rubbed his face with his hands.
"What do you know of Chimera?"
What did she know?
"Not a lot," she admitted. "Until the night you attacked me, I didn't even know there were more than the four of them. I didn't know they were an entire race."
He shook his head.
"They aren't one race. There are many. Allied."
"Oh." Karu supposed that made sense, with how unalike they were. "Does that mean there are others like Issa, like Brimstone?"
Akiva nodded. The idea gave new shades of reality to the world Karu had glimpsed. She imagined scattered tribes and vast landscapes, a whole village of Issas, families of Brimstones. She wanted to see them. Why had she been kept from them?
Akiva said, "I don't understand what your life has been. Brimstone raised you, but just in the shop, not in the fortress itself?"
"I didn't even know what was on the other side of the inner door until that night."
"He took you inside then?" Karu pursed her lips, remembering the wishmonger's fury.
"Sure. Let's say that's what happened."
"And what did you see there?"
"Why would I tell you that? Your enemies, in which case, you're my enemy too."
"I'm not your enemy, Karu."
"They're my family. Their enemies are mine."
"Family," Akiva repeated, shaking his head. "But where did you come from? Who are you really?"
"Why does everybody ask me that?" Karu asked, animated by a flash of anger, though it was something she had wondered herself almost every day since she was old enough to understand the extreme oddness of her circumstances.
"I'm me. Who are you?"
It was a rhetorical question, but he took it seriously. He said,
"I'm a soldier."
"So what are you doing here? Your war is there. Why did you come here?"
He took a deep breath, shuddering breath, sank back once more into the chair. "I needed something," he said. "Something apart. I have lived war for 50 years.
Karu interrupted him.
"You're 50? Lives are long in my world."
"Well, you're lucky," said Karu. "Here, if you want long life, you have to yank out all your teeth with pliers." The mention of teeth brought a dangerous flicker to his eyes, but he said only,
"Long life is a burden when it's spent in misery."
Misery? Did he mean himself? She asked him. His eyes fluttered shut as if he'd been struggling to keep them open and abruptly abandoned the fight. He was silent for so long that Karu wondered if he'd fallen asleep and gave up on her question. It felt intrusive anyway, and she sensed he had meant himself. She thought of the way he'd looked in Marrakesh. What made the life go out of somebody's eyes like that? Again, the caretaker impulse came to her, to offer him something, but she resisted it. She let herself stare at him. The cut of his features, the deep black of his brows and lashes, the bars inked on his hands, which were splayed open on the chair arms. With his head tilted back, she could see the welt on his neck and, a little higher up, the steady pulse of his jugular vein. Once more, his physicality struck her, that he was a flesh-and-blood being,
though unlike any she had ever seen or touched. He was a melding of elements, fire and earth. She would have thought an angel would have something of air, but he didn't. He was all substance, powerful and rugged and real. His eyes opened and she jumped, caught staring once again. How many times was she going to blush anyway?
"I'm sorry," he said, his voice faint. "I think I fell asleep."
She couldn't help it. "Do you need some water?"
"Please."
He sounded so grateful she felt a pang of guilt for not offering sooner. She untangled her legs from their lotus, rose, and brought him a glass of water, which he drained in a draft.
"Thank you,"
he said in a weirdly heartfelt way, as if he were thanking her for something much more profound than a glass of water.
Uh-huh,
she said, awkward. She felt like she was hovering, standing there. There was really nowhere in the room to go except the bed, so she scooted back onto it. She kind of wanted to take off her boots, but that was something you didn't do if there was any chance you might have to quickly flee or kick someone. Judging from Akiva's plain exhaustion, she didn't think she was in danger of either. The only danger was of foot smell. She kept her boots on. She said, "I still don't get why you burned the portals. How does that end your war?" Akiva's hands tightened on the empty water glass. He said, "There was magic coming through the doorways. Dark magic."
"From here? There's no magic here," says the flying girl.
"Okay, but that's because of a wish from your world."
"From Brimstone."
She acknowledged this with a nod.
"So you know that he's a sorcerer?"
Yeah. She'd never really thought of Brimstone as a sorcerer. Did he do more than manufacture wishes? What did she know, really, and how much did she not know? Her ignorance was like standing in pure dark that could be either a closet or a vast starless night. A kaleidoscope of images whirled in her mind, the fizz of magic when she stepped into the shop, the array of teeth and gems, the stone tables in that underground cathedral laid out with the dead who were not, as Karu had learned the hard way, actually dead. And she remembered Issa admonishing her not to make Brimstone's life any harder. His joyless life, as she had said. His relentless work. What work? She picked up a sketchbook at random, fanning past drawings of her chimera so that they made a jerky kind of animation. "What was the magic?" she asked Akiva.
"The dark magic."
He didn't answer, and she expected when she looked up to see that he had fallen asleep again, but he was watching the images flash past in her sketchbook. She snapped it closed, and his eyes fixed on her instead. Again, that vivid searching.
"What?"
she asked, discomfited.
"Karu," he said. "Hope."
She raised her eyebrows as if to say, "So?
Why did he give you that name?"
She shrugged. It was getting tiring not knowing anything. "Why did your parents name you Akiva?" At the mention of his parents, Akiva's face hardened, and the vivid watchfulness of his gaze glazed back to fatigue.
"They didn't," he said. "A steward named me from a list. Another Akiva had been killed. The name opened up."
"Oh." Karu didn't know what to make of that. It made her own strange upbringing seem cozy and familial by comparison.
"I was bred to be a soldier," Akiva said in a hollow voice.
And he closed his eyes again, tightly this time, as if gripped by a wave of pain. He was silent for a long time, and when he spoke again, he said far more than she expected.
"I was taken from my mother at 5 years old. I don't remember her face, only that she did nothing when they came for me. It's my earliest memory. I was so small that they were just legs, these looming soldiers surrounding me. They were the palace guard, so their shin plates were silver,
and I could see myself mirrored in them, in all of them, my own terrified face over and over. They took me to the training camp, where I was one of a legion of terrified children. He swallowed. Where they punished our terror and taught us to conceal it. And that became my life, the concealment of terror, until I didn't feel it anymore. Or anything else.
Karu couldn't help imagining him as a child, afraid and forsaken. Tenderness welled up in her like tears. In a fading voice, he said,
I exist only because of war. A war that began 1,000 years ago with a massacre of my people. Babies. Elders. No one spared. In a stray, the capital of the empire, the Chimera rose up to massacre the Seraphim. We are enemies because the Chimera are monsters. My life is blood, because my world is beasts. And then I came here, and humans.
A dreamlike wonder shaded into his tone.
Humans were walking freely, weaponless, gathering in the open, sitting in plazas, laughing, growing old. And I saw a girl. A girl with black eyes and gemstone hair and sadness. She had a sadness that was so deep, but it still could turn to light in a second. And when I saw her smile, I wondered what it would be like to make her smile. I thought it would be like the discovery of smiling. She was connected to the enemy, and though the only thing I wanted to do was look at her, I did what I was trained to do, and I hurt her. And when I went home, I couldn't stop thinking about you. And I was so grateful that you had defended yourself, that you didn't let me kill you.
You. Karu did not miss the pronoun shift. She sat unblinking, barely breathing.
I came back to find you, Akiva said. I don't know why. Karu, I don't know why.
His voice was so faint she could barely hear him.
Just to find you. And be in the world that you're in.
Karu waited. But he didn't say any more, and then something happened in the air around him. A shimmer. Like an aura at first, brightening to light and becoming wings. Open and upthrust from his shoulder blades to sprawl over the armchair and sweep the carpet in great arabesques of fire. His glamour had given way, and Karu almost gasped to see his wings revealed. But the flame didn't catch. It was smokeless, somehow self-contained. The subtle shifts of the fire feathers were hypnotic, and Karu breathed again, deeply, and sat watching them for minutes as Akiva's features relaxed into something like peacefulness. This time, he was truly asleep. She got up and took the water glass from his hands. She turned off the light. His wings were sufficient illumination, even for drawing. She got out her sketchbook and a pencil, and she drew Akiva asleep at the locus of his vast wings, and then from memory, with his eyes open. She tried to capture the precise shape of them. She used charcoal for the heavy black coal that rimmed them and made him look so exotic, and she couldn't take leaving his fiery irises colorless. She grabbed a watercolor box and painted. She drew and painted for a long time, and he didn't move except for the soft rise and fall of his chest and the glimmer of his wings, which cast the room in a firelike glow. Karu didn't plan to sleep, but sometime after midnight she subsided, still half on the landslide of her sketchbooks, to rest her eyes for a moment. She fell into dreams, and when she woke just before dawn, something woke her, a quick, bright sound. The room around her was, for a blink, entirely unfamiliar. Only the wings on the wall over her were not, and gave her a surge of pleasure. And then it all slid away, as dreams do. She was in her flat, of course, on her bed,
and the sound that had awakened her was Akiva. He was standing over her, and his eyes were molten. They were wide, his orange irises ringed around in white, and he was holding, one in each hand, her crescent moon knives. Chapter 31. Right. Karu sat up with a suddenness that sent sketchbooks skidding off the bed. Her pencil was still in her hand, and the thought struck her, always with a ridiculous weapon where this angel was concerned. But even as she adjusted her grip on it, ready to stab, Akiva was backing away, lowering the knives. He set them where he had found them, where she had left them, in their case, atop the nesting tables. They would have been practically under his nose when he woke. "I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't mean to frighten you." Just then, lit only by the flicker of his wings, the sight of him was so right, somehow. He was right. It made no sense at all. But the feeling flooded through Karu, and whatever it was as sweet as a patch of sun on a glossy floor, and like a cat, she just wanted to curl up in it. She tried to pretend she hadn't been about to stab him with a pencil. "Well," she said, stretching and letting it drop casually out of her hand, "I don't know your customs, but here, if you don't want to frighten someone, you don't go looming over their sleeping body with knives." Was that a smile? No, a twitch at the corners of his stern mouth. It didn't qualify. She caught sight of the sketchbook open before her, the evidence of her late-night portrait session right there for him to see. She flipped it quickly shut, though he'd of course have seen it while she was still sleeping. How could she have fallen asleep with this stranger in her flat? How could she have brought this stranger to her flat? He didn't feel like a stranger. "They're unusual," Akiva said, gesturing to the knife case. "I just got them. Beautiful, aren't they?" "Beautiful," he agreed, and he might have been talking about the knives, but he was looking straight at her. She flushed, suddenly conscious of her appearance, mussed hair, sleep drool, then got angry. What did it matter what she looked like? What exactly was going on here? She shook herself and climbed off the bed, trying to find a space in the tiny room outside his radiant aura. It was impossible. "I'll be right back," she said, and stepped into the hall and then the tiny bathroom. Separated from him, she experienced a sharp fear that she would return to find him gone. She relieved herself, wondering if Seraphim were above such mundane needs, though judging from the duskiness of his jaw, Akiva was not above the need for a razor, then splashed water on her face and brushed her teeth. She ran a brush through her hair, and every moment she lingered, her anxiety grew that when she returned, she would find just an empty room, balcony door standing open, and the whole universe of sky above giving no hint which way he'd gone. But he was still there. His wings were glamored gone again, his swords strapped in place at his back, innocuous in their decorative leather sheaths. She said. "Bathroom's in there He nodded and went past her, awkward as he tried to wedge his invisible wings into the tiny space and get the door closed. Karu hurriedly changed into clean clothes, then went to the window. It was still dark out. The clock said 5. She was starving, and knew from her previous morning's foraging that there was nothing even remotely edible in the kitchen. When Akiva emerged, she asked, "Are you hungry?"
"As if I might die of it."
"Come on, then." She picked up her coat and keys and started toward the door, then paused and changed direction. She went out onto the balcony instead, climbed up onto the balustrade, glanced back over her shoulder at Akiva, and stepped right off. 6 stories to the street, she landed like a hopscotch, unable to suppress a smile. Akiva was right beside her, unsmiling as ever. She couldn't quite imagine him smiling. He was so somber. But wasn't there something in the way he looked at her? There, in that sidelong glance, a hint of wonder? She recalled the things he'd said in the night, and now, seeing flickers of feeling interrupt the sad gravity of his face, it shot a pang through her heart. What had his life been like, given over so young to war? War. It was an abstraction to her. She couldn't conceptualize its reality, not even the edges of its reality. But the way Akiva had been, dead-eyed, and the way he looked at her now, it made her feel as if he was coming back from the dead for her. And that seemed a tremendous thing, and an intimate one. The next time their eyes met, she had to look away. She took him to her corner bakery. It wasn't open yet, but the baker sold them hot loaves through the window. Honey lavender, fresh from the oven and still steaming in their crinkly brown bags. And then Karu did what anyone would do if they could fly and found themselves out on the streets of Prague at dawn with loaves of hot bread to eat. She flew, gesturing to Akiva to follow, up into the sky and over the river to perch on the high, cold cupola of the cathedral bell tower and watch the sunrise. Akiva kept close behind her, watching the snap of her hair, its long tendrils taking on the damp of dawn. Karu had been wrong to suppose her flying didn't surprise him. It was only that he had learned over many years to crush down all feeling, all reaction. Or he thought he had. In the presence of this girl, it seemed nothing was certain. There was a neatness in the way she sliced through the air. It was magic. Not glamored wings, but simply the will to fly made manifest. A wish, he supposed, from Brimstone's own supply. Brimstone. The thought of the sorcerer came on like an ink splash, a black thought against the brightness of Karu. How could something as light as Karu's graceful flight come from the evil of Brimstone's magic? They flew above casual observation, over the river and veering in the direction of the castle, where they circled down toward the cathedral at its heart. It was a Gothic beast, carved and weathered like some tortured cliff battered by ages of storms. Karu alighted upon the cupola of the bell tower. It was not a kind perch. The wind scoured past, full of ice and ill will, and Karu had to gather her hair in her hands and hold it off her face. She produced a pencil, the same one she had brandished at him, knotted her hair, and shoved the pencil through it, an all-purpose implement. Blue wisps escaped the arrangement and danced across her brow, blowing over her eyes and catching on her lips, which were smiling with uncomplicated, childlike delight. "We're on the cathedral," she said to him. He nodded. "No. We're on the cathedral," she said again, and he thought he was missing something, some nuance lost in language. But then he realized. She was just amazed. Amazed to be perching atop the cathedral, high on the hill above Prague with everything below her. She hugged her arms around the warm bread and stood looking out, and on her face was a naked awe more potent than Akiva could ever recall feeling. Even when flying was new. It was likely he had never felt any such thing. His own early flights weren't occasion for awe or joy, only discipline. But he wanted to be part of the moment that was making her face shine like that. So he moved to her side and looked out. It was a remarkable sight, the sky beginning to flush pale at the roots, all the towers bathed in a soft glow. The streets of the city still shadowed and aglitter with fireflies of lamplight and the weaving, winking beams of headlights.
"You haven't come up here before?" he asked.
She turned to him. "Oh, yes, I bring all the boys up here."
"And if they don't meet with approval," he said, "you can always push them off."
It was the wrong thing to say. Karu's expression darkened. No doubt she was thinking of his eel. Akiva admonished himself for making an effort at humor. Of course, it would come off all wrong. It had been a long time since he'd had the will to banter. "The truth is," Karu said, letting it pass, "I only made the wish for flying a few days ago. I haven't had a chance to enjoy it yet." Again, he was surprised. It must have shown this time because Karu caught his look and said, "What?"
He shook his head.
"You were so smooth in the air, and the way you stepped off your balcony without a second's pause, as if flying is just a part of you."
She said, "You know, it didn't occur to me that the wish could wear off.
That would have been some punishment for showing off, wouldn't it? Splat!"
She laughed, untroubled by the thought, and said, "I should be more careful."
"Do the wishes wear off?"
he asked.
She shrugged.
"I don't know. I don't think so. My hair has never changed back."
"That's a wish? Brimstone let you use magic on that?"
"Well, he didn't exactly approve."
She skewed him a glance that was both sheepish and defiant.
"It's not like he ever let me have any real wishes, just enough to make minor mischief."
"Oh," a thought struck her.
"Oops."
"What?"
"I made a promise last night and forgot all about it."
She rummaged in her coat pocket and pulled out a small coin, on which Akiva glimpsed Brimstone's likeness. It was there on her palm when she closed her hand, and when she opened it, it was gone.
"Magic," she said. "Poof."
"What did you wish?"
he asked.
"Just something stupid. A mean girl somewhere down there is going to wake up happy. Not that she deserves it, hussy." She stuck out her tongue at the city, a flash of childish whimsy.
"Oh, here."
She turned to Akiva and thrust one of the bakery bags at him. "You know, so you don't die." While they ate, he saw that she was shivering, and he opened his wings, invisible, so the wind would catch their heat and fan it around her. It seemed to help. She sat down, dangling her legs over the edge, and kicked them casually while she pulled little pieces of bread off her loaf and ate them. He went into a crouch at her side.
"How are you feeling, by the way?" she asked.
"That depends," he said, feeling sly, as if Karu's whimsy were catching.
"On?"
"On whether you're asking because you're concerned for my well-being, or because you mean to keep me weak and helpless."
"Oh, weak and helpless, definitely."
"In that case, I feel awful."
"Good."
She said it seriously enough, but with a glint in her eye. Akiva realized that she had been taking care with her Hamsas, to not accidentally turn them in his direction. He was moved, as he had been when he'd awakened to find her sleeping just feet from him. So lovely and vulnerable. And her trust, like madrigals, so unearned. "I'm feeling better," he said softly.
"Thank you."
"Don't thank me, I'm the one who hurt you." Shame engulfed him.
"No," Karu agreed. "Not like that."
The wind was spiteful. With an insurgent gust, it freed her hair, then danced in to seize it. In an instant, it was everywhere, as if a pod of air elementals were trying to make off with it, to line their nests with its blue silk. She scrambled to contend with it. The pencil was lost over the roof's edge, plunging between flying buttresses, so she held her hair with both hands. Akiva waited for her to say she was ready to get down out of the wind, but she didn't. The sun climbed above the hills, and she watched as its glow herded night into the shadows, where it gathered, all the darker for its density. All of night crowded into the slanting places beyond the reach of the dawn. After a while, she said,
"You know, last night, you said your earliest memory was of the soldiers coming for you."
"I told you that?" He was startled.
"What, don't you remember?"
She turned to him, eyebrows, twin quirks, cocoa dark, raised in surprise. He shook his head, searching his mind. He'd been so ill from the devil's marks, it was all a fugue, but he couldn't believe he'd spoken of his childhood, and that day of all days. It made him feel as if he'd dragged that bereft little boy out of the past, as if, in a moment of weakness, he had become him again. He asked,
"What else did I say?"
Karu cocked her head. It was the gesture that had saved her in Marrakesh, the quick, bird-like tilt, to guard him almost sideways, and Akiva's heart sped up. Not much, she said after a moment. You fell asleep after that.
She was clearly lying. What had he said to her in the night?
Anyway, she went on, not meeting his eyes. You got me thinking, and I was trying to remember my own earliest memory. She levered herself back to her feet from the roof's edge, a move that required releasing her hair, which sprang wild back into the wind.
And?
Brimstone. A hitch in her breathing, a fond and infinitely sad smile. It's brimstone. I'm sitting on the floor behind his desk, playing with the tuft of his tail.
Playing with the tuft of his tail?
That didn't fit with Akiva's own idea of the sorcerer, which had been forged by his deepest anguish, seared into his soul like a brand.
Brimstone, he said bitter. He was good to you?
Karu was fierce in her reply. Her hair a blue torrent, her eyes hungry, she said, Always. Whatever you think you know of Chimera, you don't know him.
Isn't it possible, Karu, he said slowly, that it's you who doesn't really know him?
What, she asked, what exactly don't I know?
His magic, for one thing, said Akiva. Your wishes, do you know what they come from?
Come from?
It's not free, Karu. Magic has a price. The price is pain.
Chapter 32. Both Place and Person.
Pain. As Akiva explained, Karu felt sick. She thought of every nonsensical wish she'd ever made. Why had Brimstone never told her? The truth would have achieved what all his grumpy looks never did. She would never have made another wish if she'd known.
To take from the universe, you must give, said Akiva.
But why pain? Couldn't you give something else, like joy?
It's a balance. If it were something easy to give, it would be meaningless.
Karu said, You really think joy is easier to come by than pain? Which have you had more of?
He gave her a long look. That's a good point. But I didn't create the system.
Who did?
My people believe it was the God Stars. The Chimera have as many stories as races.
Troubled, Karu asked, Well, where does the pain come from? Is it his own pain?
Akiva said, No, Karu. It is not his own pain.
He enunciated each word carefully, and the implication hung there. If it wasn't his own pain, whose was it? She felt queasy. An image came to her of bodies laid out on tables. No. That could be something else completely. She knew Brimstone, didn't she? She might not know, well, anything about him, but she knew him, trusted him, not this angel.
Swallowing a lump in her throat, she said, I don't believe you.
Not urgently, he said,
Karu, what were the errands you did for him?
She opened her mouth to answer and closed it again. A slow wave of understanding began to creep over her, and she wanted to push it away.
Teeth, one of the great mysteries of her life. Carcasses, pliers, death.
Those Russian girls with their bloody mouths. For as long as she had been aware of Brimstone's trafficking, she had held on to the idea that he needed the teeth for something vital, and that pain was a sad and desperate corollary of it. But what if pain was the whole point? If it was how Brimstone paid for his power, for wishes, for everything?
No, she said, and shook her head. But the conviction had gone out of her.
A little while later, when she stepped back off the cathedral and into the air, her pleasure in flying was gone. Whose pain, she wondered, had paid for it? They went to a tea house on Nuradova, the long, winding road down from the castle, and Akiva proceeded to tell her about his world. Empire and civilization, uprising and massacre, cities lost and taken, lands burned, walls battered, sieges where the children starved first, no matter that their parents gave them all they had and perished soon after. He talked of bloodshed and terror in a land of failing beauty. The ancient forests have gone to build ships, siege engines, or they've been torched, so they couldn't be turned to ships and siege engines. Of hulking ruined cities, mass graves, treachery. Beast armies that kept coming and kept coming, never dwindling, never breaking. There were other things, epic, terrible things, that he didn't tell her but skirted around, like caressing the edges of a wound, hesitant, testing for pain. Karu, listening wide-eyed, horror-struck at the brutality, wished that some time in the last 17 years Brimstone had seen fit to give her a lesson in elsewhere. It occurred to her to ask, "What's it called, your world?" "Eretz," Akiva said, which caused Karu's eyebrows to shoot up. "That's Earth," she said, "in Hebrew. Why do our worlds have the same name?" "Once, the Magi believed the worlds were layered, like rock sediment or the rings of trees," said Akiva.
Okay, said Karu, brow furrowed. And then, "Magi?"
"The Seraph sorcerers."
"You said once. What do they believe now?"
"They believe nothing. The Chimera slaughtered them all."
"Oh."
Karu pursed her lips. "What could you say to something like that?"
"Well," she pondered the idea of the worlds. "Maybe we just stole the name Eretz from you way back when, the way we built our religions on the look of you."
It was what Brimstone had called a quilt of fairy tales, which humans had patched together out of glimpses. "Beauty equals good, horns and scales evil. Simple."
"And in this case, true."
Behind the counter, the waitress was staring back and forth between them. Karu wanted to ask her what she was looking at, but didn't. "So, basically," she said to Akiva, trying to gather all the things he told her into a simple strand, "the Seraphim want to rule the world, the Chimera don't want to be ruled, and that makes them evil." His jaw worked. He was displeased with the simplification.
"They were nothing but barbarians in mud villages. We gave them light, engineering, the written word."
"And took nothing for it, I'm sure."
"Nothing unreasonable."
"Uh-huh."
Karu wished she'd paid closer attention in her own human history classes so she could better imagine a context for the vast scope of what he was telling her.
"So, 1,000 years ago, for no good reason, the Chimera rose up and slaughtered their masters and took back control of their lands."
He objected. The land had never been theirs. They had small farm holdings, stone hovels, at the most villages. The cities were built by the Empire, and not just cities, viaducts, harbors, roads.
"But it was where they'd been born and died since, like the beginning of everything, where they fell in love, raised their babies, buried their elders. So what if they hadn't built cities on it? Wasn't it still theirs? I mean, unless you're going on the rule that what's yours is what you can defend, in which case anyone is within their rights at any time to try to take anything from anyone else. That's hardly civilization."
"You don't understand."
"No, I don't."
Akiva took a deep breath.
"We built the world in good faith. We lived alongside them."
"As equals?"
Karu asked.
"You keep calling them beasts, so I have to wonder."
He didn't answer right away.
"What have you seen of them, Karu? Did you say 4 Chimera, and none of them warriors? When you have seen your brothers and sisters gored by minotaurs, mauled by lion dogs, ripped to pieces by dragons, when you have seen your... Whatever he was about to say, he bit it off hard, with a look of agony. When you have been tortured and forced to witness the execution of loved ones, then you can speak to me of what makes a beast.
Loved ones? He didn't mean brothers and sisters the way he said that. Karu felt a pang of... Surely it wasn't jealousy. What did it matter who he loved or had loved? She swallowed. What could she say? She couldn't contradict a thing he'd told her. Her ignorance was entire. But that didn't mean she had to just believe him, either.
I'd like to hear Brinstone's side, she said quietly.
Something occurred to her then. Something big.
You could take me there. You could take me back.
He blinked, startled, then shook his head.
No. It's no place for humans.
And this is a place for angels?
It's not the same. It's safe here.
Oh, really? Tell my scars how safe it is here.
She pulled the collar of her shirt out of shape to reveal the puckered slash of scar tissue across her collarbone. Akiva winced at the sight of it. Ugly, and of his own making. And Karu set her collar back in place.
Besides, she argued, there are more important things than safety. Like, loved ones.
She felt cruel using his words, like she was twisting a knife.
Loved ones, he repeated.
I told Brimstone I would never just leave him, and I won't. I'm going, even without your help.
How do you plan to do that?
There are ways, she said, cagey.
But it would be easier if you would take me.
Easier indeed. What a preferable traveling companion Akiva would be to Razgut. But he said, I can't take you. The portal is guarded. You'd be killed on sight.
You Seraphim do a lot of that, killing on sight.
The monsters have made us who we are.
Monsters. Karu thought of Issa's laughing eyes, Yasri's excitable flutter and soothing touch. She called them monsters herself sometimes, but fondly, the same way she called Zuzana rabid. From Akiva's mouth, the word was just ugly.
Beasts, devils, monsters. If you'd ever known any chimera, you couldn't dismiss them like that.
He dropped his eyes and didn't answer, and the thread of their conversation was lost in a tense silence. She thought he looked pale, still unwell. The tea mugs were big earthen affairs without handles, and Karu cupped hers with both hands. She kept her palms flat against it, both to warm them up after the frigid hours atop the cathedral, and to prevent herself from inadvertently flashing any painful magic at Akiva. Across the table, his pose mirrored her own, his hands also wrapped around his mug, so that she couldn't help seeing his tattoos. The repeating black bars across the tops of his fingers. Each one was slightly raised, like scar tissue, and Karu thought that, unlike hers, they were just cuts rubbed in lamp black, a primitive procedure. The longer she looked at them, the more she was seized with a strange sense of knowing something, or almost knowing it. It was as if she was at the cusp of an awareness, vibrating between knowing and not knowing, so fast that she couldn't quite register what it was, like trying to see the wings of a bee in flight. She couldn't fix on it. Akiva saw her staring, and it made him self-conscious. He shifted, covering one hand with the other, as if he could blot out the tattoos.
Do yours have magic in them, too? Karu asked.
No, he said. She thought a little gruffly.
What then? Do they mean something?
He didn't answer, and she reached out, unthinking, to trace them with her fingertip. They were in a classic five-count pattern. For every four lines, the fifth was a diagonal strike through.
It's a count, she said,
as her fingertip moved lightly from one five-count to the next on his right index finger. 5, 10, 15, 20. and each time she touched him, it was like a leaping spark and a call. A call to entwine her fingers in his, and even, God, what was wrong with her? To lift his hands to her lips and kiss the marks there. And then, out of nowhere, she knew. She knew what they tallied and snatched back her hand. She stared at him and he sat there, unguarded, ready to accept whatever judgment she would lash at him. "They're kills," she said faint. "They're chimera." He didn't deny it. As when she had attacked him, he wouldn't defend himself. His hands stayed where they were, still as bones, and Karun knew he was fighting the urge to hide them. She was shaking, staring at those marks, thinking of the ones she'd touched. 20 on one index finger alone. "So many," she said. "You've killed so many." "I'm a soldier." Karu imagined her own 4 chimera dead, and put a hand over her mouth, afraid she might be sick. When he'd been telling her of the war, it was a world away. But Akiva was real and right in front of her, and the fact that he was a killer was real now, too. Like teeth spilled across Brimstone's desk, all those marks stood for blood. Death. Not of wolves and tigers, but the blood and death of Chimera. She was looking at him, fixed on him, and she saw something. As if the moment split like an eggshell to reveal another moment inside it. Almost indistinguishable from it. Almost. And then it was gone, and time stood intact. Akiva was just as he had been, and nothing at all had happened. But that glimpse. Karu heard herself say in a vague voice that might have emanated from within that eggshell moment, "You have more now." "What?" Akiva regarded her blank, then like lightning strike, not blank. He sat sharply forward, his eyes wide and flashing, a sudden movement upsetting his tea. "What?" he said again, louder. Karu drew back. Akiva seized her hand. "What do you mean, I have more now?" She shook her head. More marks, she'd meant. She had seen something in that spliced moment. There was the real Akiva sitting before her, and there was a flash of the impossible, too. Akiva smiling. No grim twist of the lips, but warm with wonderment, a smile so beautiful it ached. There were crinkles at the corners of his eyes, which were merry, and a squint with unself-conscious happiness. The change was profound. If he was beautiful when grave, and he was, smiling, he was nothing short of glorious. But Karu would swear that he had not smiled. And that impossible Akiva who had existed for that instant, there had been something else. His hands had carried fewer marks, some of his fingers entirely bare of them. Her hand was still in his, resting in the puddle of his spilled tea. The waitress came out from behind the counter and stood poised with a towel, uncertain. Karu extricated her hand and sat back to let her wipe up the mess, which she did, still glancing back and forth between them. When she was finished, she asked hesitantly, "I was just wondering. I was wondering how you did it." Karu looked at her, uncomprehending. The waitress was a girl about her own age, full-cheeked and flushed. "Last night," she clarified. "The flying." "Ah, the flying." "You are there?" Karu asked. It seemed a strange coincidence. "I wish," said the girl. "I saw it on TV. It's been on the news all morning." "Oh," thought Karu. "Oh." Her hand went to her phone, which had been giving off snippy snorts and buzzes for the past hour or so, and she checked its screen. Missed calls and texts spooled across it, most from Zuzana and Kaz. "Damn." "Were there wires?" the waitress asked. "They couldn't find any wires or anything." Karu said, "No wires. We were really flying."
then gave her trademark wry smile. The girl beamed back, thinking she was part of a joke.
"Don't tell me, then,"
she said, mock angry, and she left them alone except to bring Akiva more tea. He was still sitting back, regarding Karu with those lightning-strike wide eyes and that vivid, searching wariness.
"What?" she asked, self-conscious.
"Why are you looking at me like that?" He lifted his hands and raked his nails through his dense, cropped hair, holding on to his head for a beat.
"I can't help it," he said, abashed.
Karu experienced a fizz of pleasure. She realized that over the course of the morning, all the hardness had gone from his face, or nearly. His lips were softly parted, his gaze unguarded, and now that she'd seen, imagined, that impossible flash of a smile, it wasn't so difficult to imagine it could happen again, and for real this time. For her, maybe.
"Oh, God, be that cat," she reminded herself, the one that stayed out of reach and never, ever purred.
Sitting back, she composed her features in what she hoped was the human version of feline disdain. She gave him the gist of what she'd learned from the waitress, though she wasn't sure he really understood about television, let alone the internet, or phones for that matter.
"Can you give me a minute?"
she asked him, and she dialed Zuzana, who picked up on the first ring. Her voice exploded in Karu's ear.
"Karu?
It's me.
Oh my God, are you all right? I saw you on the news. I saw him. Holy Jesus, Karu, do you realize that you are flying?"
"I know. Isn't it awesome?"
"It is not awesome. Unawesome. I thought you were dead somewhere."
She was on the edge of hysteria, and it took Karu a few minutes to calm her, all the while mindful of Akiva's eyes on her and trying to keep her feline cool.
"You're really okay?" Zuzana asked. "He doesn't have, like, a knife to your throat forcing you to say you are?"
"He doesn't even speak Czech," Karu assured her, then gave her a quick rundown of the previous night, letting her know he hadn't tried to hurt her, had gone to extremes of passiveness to not hurt her, and finishing with, "We, watched the sunrise from the top of the cathedral."
"The hell? Was it a date?"
"No, it wasn't a date. Honestly, I don't know what it was, I don't know what he's doing here." Her voice faltered as she looked at him. It wasn't just the smile or the marks on his hands. She knew somehow that his right shoulder was a mass of scar tissue. He favored it. She'd seen that. That must be how she knew. Why, then, did she know what the scars looked like? Felt like?
"Karu? Hello? Karu?"
Karu blinked and cleared her throat. It had happened again. Her own name floating right past, unconnected to herself. She sensed from Zuzana's agitation that she had been missing in action for a few beats past any acceptable span of zoning out.
"I'm here," she said.
"Where?"
"I keep asking you, where are you?"
Karu had momentarily forgotten.
Oh, the tea house on Nuradova."
"Sit. Stay. I'm coming there."
"No, you're not."
"Yes, I am."
"Zuz,
Karu, don't make me hurt you with my tiny fists."
"Fine,"
Karu relented.
"Come on, then."
Zuzana boarded with a widow aunt in Hrodkiny, not far away.
"I'll be there in 10, she said.
Karu couldn't resist telling her.
"It's faster if you fly."
"Freak, don't you dare leave, and don't let him leave either. I have threats to deliver, judgments to pass."
"I don't think he's going anywhere," said Karu,
and she looked straight at Akiva as she said it, and he looked back, molten, and she knew it was true, but she didn't know why. He wasn't human. He wasn't even from her world. He was a soldier with scores of kills on his hands. And he was the enemy of her family. And yet, something tied them together, stronger than any of that.
Something with the power to conduct her blood and breath like a symphony, so that anything she did to fight against it felt like discord, like disharmony with herself. As far back as she could remember, a phantom life had mocked her with its impenetrable something else. But now it was the opposite. Here, in the circle of Akiva's presence, even as they spoke of war and siege and enduring enmity, she felt herself being drawn into the warm absoluteness and rightness of him, like he was both place and person, and contrary to all reason, exactly where she was supposed to be. Chapter 33. Preposterous.
"My tiny scary friend is coming here," Karu told Akiva, drumming her fingers on the table.
"The one from the bridge."
Karu recalled that he had been following her yesterday and would have seen Zuzana perform.
She nodded. "She knows about your world a little. And she knows you tried to kill me, so..."
"Should I be afraid?" Akiva asked,
and for a second, Karu thought he was serious. He always looked so serious, but it was another hint of dry humor, like atop the cathedral when he had surprised her with his joke about pushing off bad dates.
"Terribly afraid," she replied. "All cower before her. You'll see."
Her mug was empty, but she kept her palms on it. Less now for fear of flashing magic at Akiva than to keep her hands from making any more unsanctioned sallies across the table to touch his. She should have been repelled by his hands with their death count, and she was, but not only. Side by side with the horror was the pull. She knew he felt it too, that his hands were fighting their own battle not to reach for hers. He kept looking at her, and she kept blushing. And their conversation stuttered along until the door opened and Zuzana stomped in. She came straight to the table and stood facing Akiva. She was fierce, ready to scold. But when she saw him, really saw him, she faltered. Her expression warred with itself, ferocity with awe, and awe won out. She cast a sidelong glance at Karu and said, in helpless amazement,
"Oh, hell. Must mate immediately."
It was so unexpected, and Karu was already so on edge that laughter burst from her. She sank back in her chair and let it pour out, soft, glittering laughter that worked another change in Akiva's countenance as he watched her with a hopeful, piercing scrutiny that made her tingle. She felt so seen.
"No, really," said Zuzana. "Right now, it's like a biological imperative, right? To get the best genetic material? And this,"
she made spokesmodel hands at Akiva,
"is the best genetic material I have ever seen."
She pulled up a chair beside Karu, so the two of them were like a gallery observing the seraph.
"Viala would so eat her words. You should bring him in to model on Monday."
"Right," said Karu. "I'm sure he wouldn't mind stripping for a bunch of humans."
"Disrobing," said Zuzana, prim, "for art."
"Are you going to introduce us?" Akiva asked.
The chimera tongue, which they had been using all along, now sounded out of place, like a rough echo from another world. Karu nodded, fanning away laughter.
"I'm sorry," she said, and made a cursory introduction. "Of course, I'll have to translate if you want to say anything to each other."
"Ask him if he's in love with you," said Zuzana at once.
Karu almost choked. She turned her whole body in her chair to face Zuzana, who held up a hand before she could protest.
I know, you're not going to ask him that. And you don't even need to. He so is. Look at him. I'm afraid he's going to set you on fire with his crazy orange eyes."
It did feel like that. Karu had to admit. But love? That was preposterous. She said so.
"You want to know what's preposterous?" said Zuzana,
still studying Akiva, who looked bemused by her appraisal.
"That Virus Peak is preposterous. God, really makes you feel the sad dearth of Widow's Peaks in daily life. We could, like, use him as breeding stock to seed Widow's Peaks into the populace.
My God, what's with all the mating and seed talk?
I'm just saying, Zuzana said.